Good morning, all. I'm Steve Swordlow, Central Asia researcher, one of two on our team, and I'm really happy to see you all here. And not only that you braved the snow to get here, but also we're not discussing Ukraine this morning, so I'm also grateful for your attention and your interest. I thought that what I would try to do is make an overview of some of Human Rights Watch's key concerns, human rights concerns, concerning Uzbekistan, talk about some of the developments in the last year, mostly bad, but some that made developments that offer cause for some hope in terms of how to engage with Uzbekistan. And then I thought I'd move to maybe some observations or lessons that we can draw for how the international community, and specifically the United States, engages with Uzbekistan. One can't describe Uzbekistan's human rights situation in any other term than as atrocious. Unfortunately, it has remained so for many years. And that is because the human rights situation is so poor across a very wide spectrum of violations. And I'm sure many of you are experts on the region and know a lot of this information, but it might be useful to dwell on some of the key developments in the last year that drive home just how badly in need Uzbekistan is of improvement in terms of its human rights situation. Uzbekistan is still virtually closed to independent scrutiny. Uzbekistan, even before the Andijan massacre, but rapidly in the aftermath of the Andijan massacre, expelled most international NGOs, media outlets, and cracked down dramatically and repressively on the civil society that existed in Uzbekistan. And human rights defenders are harassed, intimidated, and very isolated by their situation, and increasingly abandoned by the international community in the years and now the 9 years since Andijan. Freedom of expression in Uzbekistan is severely limited. There's no freedom of press. There are no independent publications, no opposition news, independent or opposition newspapers or websites. Censorship is near complete. And of course, there's no real meaningful political competition or participation to speak of, despite it now being over 3 years since President Karimov gave a much hailed speech in November 2010 about the need to increase participation of civil society and create a multi-party political system. Torture in Uzbekistan remains systematic, and this is an issue that received a lot of attention this year. In November, the United Nations Committee Against Torture held its 51st or its 50th session, in which it reviewed Uzbekistan's compliance with the Convention Against Torture. And it was a very interesting event, which I'll try to return to more in my observations about how to engage with Uzbekistan. I think it teaches us something about the notion that Uzbekistan is not immune to criticism from the international community and does respond to both, you know, public condemnations of its record, but also recommendations and key asks to make improvements. But the committee essentially found that torture remains systematic and unpunished. It's something that is used in police stations and prisons, often as a substitute for the actual work of police investigation. It's a way to obtain forced confessions. And Human Rights Watch has documented several cases just in the last year of pretrial detainees being tortured. I don't know if I should. I might mention just one as an example of torture in Uzbekistan that we documented from September of 2013 in the city of Parkent. A 24-year-old man named Zahid Umetaliyev was accused of stealing a cell phone. This was not a political crime by any means. His mother, who we interviewed, reported that three officers beat her son on the way to the police station with rubber clubs. The beatings continued as they entered the building. Umetaliyev later told his mother that he was beaten continuously on the legs, the head, the face, and the body while in the police station until he was taken to court. He was sentenced to 15 days of detention by the judge for resisting arrest, even though there was no evidence that he had resisted arrest. He was transferred to a detention center where he was booked and fingerprinted. But then, late at night, and this is a practice that unfortunately we've seen in several cases this year, he was transferred from his holding cell to a different prison where his detention was not recorded, where he was subject to brutal torture for the next 3 days. We've noted this in a few cases where Uzbek authorities often transfer inmates from detention facilities to other prisons where they don't record their detention, where they are free with impunity to ill-treat them and torture them. That also came out in the case this year of a case that the press actually looked at closely. The former British security guard, at the British embassy in Tashkent, a man named Kayum Ortikov, who was accused of espionage and was tortured for 9 months in the custody of the National Security Services in Tashkent, even though he had been sentenced under different charges and was supposed to serve out his sentence in a different location. The United Nations Committee Against Torture noted this case, the Umit Aliyev case, in its concluding observations, and it was one example where it found that torture remains unpunished and requires serious scrutiny. In that same general area, one notable development, and negative one, was that the International Committee for the Red Cross, which conducts independent monitoring in prisons and jails, and had with great difficulty continued to work in Uzbekistan for several years being kicked out after Andijan, was forced in April, in a very rare development, to publicly announce that it was no longer able to carry out its mission because its own procedures of confidentiality were being interfered with. And you know, that's obviously a sign of things being extremely difficult when the ICRC, which makes no public statements about abuses and operates in situations of confidentiality, is forced to terminate its work. Of course, another major issue on the human rights landscape is forced labor. Forced labor, also there were some key developments this year which we can discuss, but forced labor remains a widespread problem in Uzbekistan, which involves upwards of 2 million adults and children. Human Rights Watch is part of the Cotton Campaign, and there are local NGOs and international NGOs that have been looking at the cotton harvest in Uzbekistan for many years. And this past year showed that despite some improvements, despite a shift away from the use of the youngest kids out in the cotton fields, 15, 16, and 17-year-old children were still en masse mobilized to pick cotton for weeks at a time, live in abusive conditions where they received little to no pay and really faced a variety of abuses. Also, interestingly, the shift away from younger children meant that older individuals were mobilized. You had a larger number of adults and increasingly large numbers of public sector employees, teachers, doctors, nurses, being mobilized to pick cotton in Uzbekistan, which, of course, leads to a deterioration of social services. Classes are obviously shut down, but so are medical clinics, hospitals. And this is a six-week to two-month ordeal that takes the place of all regular activities in Uzbekistan every year and severely disrupts the economy and the life of its citizens. The ILO was able to visit Uzbekistan this year, and it did, after many years, was able to conduct a limited monitoring mission of the cotton harvest. But unfortunately, the ILO mission that got into the country was severely limited in scope and its own modalities. It was staffed in part by Uzbek government representatives that accompanied the monitors that traveled around the fields looking at the issue of forced labor. And we feel that may have led to citizens not being able to be completely straightforward or feel safe in giving testimony as to the reality of human rights abuses in Uzbekistan. I should, of course, mention that political prisoners, human rights activists, journalists, is the imprisonment of human rights defenders and journalists continues to be a grave problem. There are well over a dozen human rights activists and journalists languishing in Uzbekistan's jails and prisons for no other reason than their legitimate civic activism. And of course, add to that the thousands of peaceful religious believers in Uzbekistan who have been imprisoned on overly broad and vague charges of so-called extremism. And you get a picture of a country in which thousands of people on politically motivated charges are behind bars, which is quite, even for the former Soviet Union, is quite unique and really calls out for attention. I should probably, in the interest of time, just turn to some of the observations about engagement with Uzbekistan. And maybe just as a transition to that, say that 2014 marks 13 years now, 12 years actually, since a single UN special mechanism on human rights, a special rapporteur on human rights, was able to visit the country, which makes Uzbekistan a real record holder in its, I should say, blatant non-cooperation with UN human rights bodies, UN mechanisms. There are very few countries in the world that refuse to allow UN experts to visit the country. Zimbabwe has a worse record, but that may be the only country that has denied a larger number of UN experts, human rights experts, to come to the country. Uzbekistan was very defiant about its own record at the Human Rights Council during the Universal Periodic Review, which is a seminal event on examining the human rights situation in the country at the UN. The Uzbek government, you know, essentially denied and rejected almost all the recommendations on human rights in the September session. And then in November, the Uzbek government at the UN Committee Against Torture also was very, very openly defiant about reports of torture. But why then did I say that maybe there's some cause for hope and some lessons that we can draw which are positive? I think the answer is that we've seen signs that pressure works, that the Uzbek government, in fact, is not entirely immune and actually does take steps to respond to robust criticism. And at least in my view, it should inform the discussion here in Washington about kicking up the pressure, about finding ways to more publicly and robustly advance a human rights conversation with Uzbekistan, not only behind closed doors, but in public. And what evidence is there of this claim that I'm making? Well, one is that a few months ago, we saw reports that two NGOs in Uzbekistan were able to visit high-profile political prisoners. Agzam Turgunov is a public defender in Uzbekistan who's long known for his human rights work and has been in prison since about 2008 or 9. Dilmurod Said is a journalist, an independent journalist, who was a muckraker and really fearless journalist who's been in prison since about the same time. They were both visited by Surat Ikramov, a well-known human rights activist, and Ezgulik, another locally registered human rights group. When those visits came, these were really surprising developments, because NGOs in Uzbekistan are not even allowed to register, let alone visit prisons or visit political prisoners. So why did this happen? Why were they allowed to see political prisoners and report on their conditions? I think it's because the UN Committee Against Torture was sufficiently robust and public in its criticism of Uzbekistan's woeful record in cooperating with its obligations, allowing the ICRC to make visits and the ombudsman to have a functioning ombudsman mechanism in Uzbekistan. There was a lot of time spent. If you go to the video, which is public on YouTube, a lot of time was spent sort of taking Uzbekistan's government to task for not living up to its obligations in this area. And lo and behold, about a month later, these visits were provided. I think that's one example that pressure does work. What's another example? Another example is that while it had its shortcomings, the ILO was able to get into Uzbekistan because Uzbekistan faced some consequences. Uzbekistan, in June, was designated as a Tier 3 country by the State Department. It was put into the lowest category in the rankings of countries in terms of their their efforts to combat human trafficking and forced labor. That was a significant development in here in Washington, considering Uzbekistan's geostrategic importance in the war in Afghanistan. And it was, I think, in some sense, probably a hard-fought battle, even within the U.S. government, but it was a good decision. And within a month of that designation, there was serious movement for the first time on getting access for the ILO to visit Uzbekistan. So that's another example, I think, where we can say that by marshaling resources, by publicly at least, you know, honestly assessing an abysmal human rights situation, Uzbekistan does respond. And finally, just one last example of this is that Uzbekistan also cares about its abysmal record on freedom of religion. This is an issue that the U.S. government has engaged on with Uzbekistan. I see an expert in the room, Kathy Kosman, who was recently in Uzbekistan with the Commission on International Religious Freedom. And Uzbekistan does not like that every year it's designated as a country of particular concern, a CPC, a designation which carries with it the possibility of sanctions. But it was interesting to me that about a few weeks ago, the state-sponsored media issued a response to reports that Human Rights Watch had put out in its World Report decrying violations of freedom of religion. And the Uzbek government tried to defend its record, talked about, you know, tolerance and multiculturalism, and at least what that said to me was that Uzbekistan is engaging, that it cares, that it does worry about its image, and that it will have a conversation. And that'll be a difficult conversation, but I think it means that we should try as best we can to use our leverage to make improvements. So, thank you.
Thank you all for coming today. It's great to have a room full of people to engage in this discussion about human rights, the deteriorating human rights situation in Kazakhstan, and obviously serious human rights concerns in Uzbekistan as well. Kazakhstan is a country that has experienced great economic growth over the last 20 plus years, and it's something that's important to note. However, its human rights record has been problematic for a long time, and over the last 2 years since violent clashes in western Kazakhstan has seriously deteriorated. For those of you who don't know, following prolonged labor strikes in the oil sector in western Kazakhstan, there were clashes on December 16th, 2011 in Zhanaozen, which resulted in 12 people being killed by police. And since then, authorities have cracked down on free speech and dissent through the misuse of overbroad and vague laws, particularly the charge of inciting social, national, clan, racial, or religious discord, by suspending or shutting down independent and opposition media and newspapers, and by detaining and imprisoning critics, such as opposition leader Vladimir Kozlov and oil worker Rosa Tulitayeva. Vladimir Kozlov was put in, well, I'll come back to him, actually. Long-standing issues relating to freedom of assembly and freedom of religion remain serious concerns. There have been some developments in terms of tackling impunity for torture over the last year, but it does remain the norm in Kazakhstan as well. So I'll focus a bit on some of our key issues, and then we're looking forward to a discussion and comments about our findings. In terms of freedom of expression, in December 2012, courts banned Vzhlyad and Golos Respubliki and their affiliated websites and prohibited Kaplus and Stan TV from broadcasting in quick perfunctory trials relating to their work on reporting on the Zhanaozen violence and the aftermath. Throughout 2013 and into 2014, newspapers have been suspended for up to 3 months or shut down for technical violations or administrative violations. Just to note a couple of those, the youth newspaper Jez Kazgan was closed in January last year. Just last month, Pravdivaya Gazeta was also shut down, and Pravda Kazakhstana was suspended twice last year for up to 3 months. Authorities, something that we have been repeatedly calling on the Kazakhstan government to address is the misuse of the charge of inciting social discord. This was first used against Natalia Sokolova, who was a union lawyer who represented the workers at one of the companies where strikes took place. She was sentenced to 6 years in prison, although her sentence was later converted and she was released on a suspended sentence. It was used and brought against Vladimir Kozlov, And it was also brought against a number of other activists who were held in detention for 6 months and then later released. This is a charge that is vague in its definition and has been used to criminalize behavior and speech that is protected under international human rights law. Although we've called for it to be repealed or amended, as have other international bodies like the European Parliament, under the ongoing legislative reforms that are underway, the criminal code, criminal procedural code, etc., which I'll come back to, but it has been proposed that this charge is increased in scope to include also class discord, and its penalties increased to 20 years in prison. So rather than addressing the concerns that this does not meet international human rights standards, in fact, we're seeing a refusal to bring the legislation in line with its international commitments. In terms of freedom of assembly, no doubt many of you will have heard about the case just a couple of weeks ago of three bloggers who were sentenced to 15 days in administrative detention for attempting to meet with the mayor of Almaty City. Soon after, another blogger staged a one-person protest, and she was her protest was broken up by police. She was given a warning by court after repeated delays. Freedom of assembly is highly restricted in Kazakhstan due to a restrictive law that requires permission to hold peaceful protests 10 days in advance. And we've seen how authorities have consistently used this over the years to curb freedom of assembly. Another kind of very something that's quite exemplifies how the authorities are using this law is in the months after the Zhanaozen violence, civil society activists staged peaceful protests once monthly, starting in December, January 2012, and the organizers and participants were detained or prevented from attending. Some of them were fined, and several of them were imprisoned for up to 15 days. This just shows how much the space for dissent in Kazakhstan is curbed and limited. Last year, Kazakhstan adopted a national torture prevention mechanism, which was quite a positive development. However, impunity for torture does remain the norm. This was particularly evident in the aftermath of the Zhanaozen violence. Human Rights Watch documented how police kicked and beat with truncheons, stripped naked and walked on and subjected to freezing temperatures detainees who had been brought into custody in the few days immediately after the violence. During the trial of those who were accused of participating or organizing the riots, there were also wide allegations that were voiced in trial. And while a preliminary investigation was ordered by the judge, it was not carried out in a way that would have brought about any accountability for those allegations. As it concerns, in particular, Rosa Tulitaeva, who was one of the more outspoken activists, oil workers who participated in the strikes and who regularly gave comment to the media, her allegations did not prompt a criminal investigation, and to date, those have gone uninvestigated. I mentioned the criminal code legislative reforms that are underway. This is part of a broad overhauling of legislation in Kazakhstan. We have looked specifically at several provisions in the criminal code, and we sent a letter to the Prosecutor General's office that I don't have a copy of with me, but I would encourage you to look at if you're interested. It shows that as it concerns fundamental freedoms, speech, assembly, association, and religion, the amendments are again moving Kazakhstan away from meeting its international human rights obligations. In particular, one article that also concerns work that we've done on labor rights, that is actions provoking an illegal strike, is a new amendment to the criminal code that penalizes persons calling on workers or others to participate in a strike that's been declared illegal by a court. In our research that we did on the strikes that preceded the crackdown in Zhanaozen, we found that there's a broad prohibition on the right to strike in Kazakhstan in certain sectors, in particular in the oil sector, that there are burdensome collective bargaining requirements, and there's interference in the work of unions, mass dismissals that took place after these strikes. But the problematic issue with this new legislative amendment is that it is nearly impossible to have legal strikes in certain sectors, and therefore criminalizing calling on workers to continuing a strike does not meet Kazakhstan's international obligations by any means. Freedom of religion is another serious issue. There was a new law that was introduced in 2010, the result which required all religious groups in Kazakhstan to undergo re-registration throughout the course of the year. That resulted in smaller religious groups being shut down, unable to fulfill the requirements for re-registration. And in addition, there are reports of raids and fines for people who are practicing their faith outside of these state controls. And recently, a pastor of Grace Church in Astana was found guilty of causing harm to one of his congregation members, although she herself had claimed that there was no harm caused. This was a prolonged trial. He was one of several people over the course of the last year who was required to undergo forced psychiatric observation. This is a very problematic procedure in place in Kazakhstan, given that it puts detainees, it isolates them from their lawyers and from their families for up to a month. It is unclear what goes on in that time. In the two cases that we're aware of concerning this pastor, as well as the case of a journalist in eastern Kazakhstan, Alexander Harlamov, who's another person to be who was arrested under this inciting religious discord charge that I mentioned previously, he has been released since then. In those two cases, both of these people were found sane. They were not therefore charged with or brought suffered as a result of this in a way that both of them they were found to be criminally sane and therefore stood charges on the stood trial on the charges. In the case of Bakhitjan, the pastor, I'm going to stop there. I'm sorry, feeling a bit ill, losing my train of thought. I'm sorry. I think I'll conclude there that the situation in Kazakhstan is, while there are quiet repressions underway, and there is a clear deterioration of the rights situation when we're talking about fundamental human rights, and these are not widely outspokenly acknowledged by the international community. And I would be keen on hearing your views on this interplay of kind of geopolitical interest in a country versus having a principled position on what are deterioration of human rights standards. And I apologize for being sick and losing my train of thought there. Thank you very much.
So maybe I could just start off by asking our speakers to address one question, which is that for the first time in living memory, the State Department actually issued the annual Human Rights Report when it's legally mandated to do it. And I assume by now that you've had a chance to read the chapters on Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and the other Central Asian countries. And just without going into too much detail, your take on those reports and how they match with Human Rights Watch's findings, or if you don't.
Sure. You know, I think the country reports remain one of the most important sources of information on the human rights situation. I think, you know, generally speaking, I think Human Rights Watch, and I can say on Uzbekistan just now, you know, I find it to be highly credible, extremely very thorough and comprehensive. With that said, you know, there are some things that have been popping up, I guess, more and more in the language of the Uzbek chapter in the past several years. One is, you know, it's less about sort of the facts that are reported than the premises or I should say methodology that stands behind some of the claims. Or let me be even more precise. There needs to be recognition in terms of how limited there is a space in which to report on human rights in Uzbekistan and bring to the attention of the U.S. Embassy that writes the first draft of the report abuses that are happening, you know, underneath their noses, in a way, one could say, but all across the country. And one thing that's so problematic, torture, the way torture is described, the way forced labor is described, there are a lot of key points that are made that are extremely helpful. But one of the problems I see is often some paragraphs will begin, there were no reports of such and such abuse. And one asks themselves the question, is that because there are no abuses of such a sort? Or is that because for many years now, local human rights activists have not only, again, as I said, not been registered by the government to even operate, have an office, operate in some semblance of normalcy and do their work, but they're harassed, they're in prison, they actually risk, arbitrary detention simply when they leave their homes to come to the U.S. Embassy and have meetings with the human rights officer that may, be taking the reports. Is that a reason there are no reports? Is another reason that there are no reports on certain abuses because journalists can't report on them? There are no international media outlets. For example, the New York Times tried again this year to get into Uzbekistan, was unsuccessful in doing so. That seems to point to the fact that the Uzbek government makes a very active attempt to hide the truth, to cover up abuses. And I think that has to be somehow... So, again, my opinion is that in the Uzbekistan chapter, the one thing that could be added and should be added is some discussion of the closing space for civil society and the continued effort by the authorities to make it impossible for human rights monitors to do their jobs. And obviously, what that does is it shifts the burden on all questions to the government to rebut that such abuses are not happening, unfortunately. I would take that position, that the evidentiary burden must shift to the Uzbek government to deny that certain thing, to show and prove that certain abuses that we know are happening are not happening. So that would be my comment.
Broadly speaking, the report issued by the U.S. government on the rights situation in Kazakhstan addresses our key concerns about the limitations on freedom of assembly and freedom of expression, notes inciting social discord problems, for instance. I did, however, note that the case of Roza Tulitayeva, who was one of the key figures in the strikes that took place in 2011, was not noted, although Vladimir Kozlov, the leader of the opposition movement, Algal, was. As I mentioned, her case of torture was uninvestigated, so there were opportunities to put her in a way, either through concerns about torture or concerns about individuals who were imprisoned on unfair trials. So that's something that I noted. The problem that I see, again, also is this discord between knowing the facts and talking about them. And the U.S. Embassy in Kazakhstan does not consistently raise concern about these developments that are happening on the ground when there were these perfunctory trials and the closure of media outlets. These are ongoing closures of media, of newspapers, for instance, the curbing space for freedom of expression, either in terms of freedom of assembly or by voicing complaint about government policies, that these should be noted. This also lends support to civil society activists who are working in Kazakhstan to know that that the embassy is aware of these issues and is speaking out publicly about them. So there is that discord to note.
Just one thing that I forgot to mention is that on forced labor, the chapter did say that the ban on the use of child labor was effectively enforced. I think that was the language. But that conflicts with some of the reports, with the reports that we have in the Cotton Campaign, that when it comes to kids, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds were, in fact, mobilized en masse. So it's not just forced labor that continues, but child labor as well.
So let me open it up to questions and comments again about any of the countries in the regions. Sir, please identify yourself.
Nurgali Arslanov from Kazakhstan Embassy. As far as the representation of Kazakhstan is concerned, it seems to me it's very biased because it just cherry picks only the negative aspects of what's happening in Kazakhstan. There are lots of positive things. Look at Kazakhstan since 1990, when the country was born. The GDP per capita was about $400 or $700. Now it's $18,000. It's a tremendous progress. what gives us this back? This gives it a huge empowerment for all our citizens, the emancipation of people from the poverty, great kind of development of citizenship. Human rights is about political rights as well as economic rights. Mm-hmm. So this economic rights have been expanded significantly. Mm-hmm. As far as institutional progress is concerned, you did mention this Congress of World Religions, mm-hmm. that we are promoting at the global level to promote interfaith dialogue. And also, you are, I think, a great expert on human rights, and you should inject at the front of time to time some positive things that we are doing. And Kazakhstan is it's very symbolic that we're here at the Open Society Institute. Kazakhstan is an open society. And you yourself visited, I think, Kazakhstan several times and engaged with the government. Mm-hmm. There are lots of NGOs. The outcome of this report is the outcome of the discussions and the exchanges, engagements with the local NGOs. We are living in a globalized society. Mm-hmm. And I think there's part of the contribution of Kazakhstan to human rights should be recognized. And if you can add about the positive sides of the global data.
Well, can I add to my colleagues? I'm sorry, just to take the floor. Just, I'm also from Kazakh Embassy. I will not engage into proving that this is not correct. This is a little bit different. This is some, okay. If you want, you may find different readings of this thing. There are different readings of each case you have mentioned. My kind of question or remark more to the. You have admitted that main purpose of your research is to provide a tool for external foreign policy pressure in relations between one state and towards another state. I would propose to have a different approach, which we in Kazakhstan for many years now are now practicing. It is a follow-up practical engagement. And instead of ad hoc country visits, a permanent-based interaction, which we are doing in Kazakhstan. Are you in contact with Civic Forum of Kazakhstan? This represents thousands and thousands of NGOs actively interacting with the government, actively pushing, pressing out, etc., etc. Instead of providing tools for another government to press another government, it's better to work in Kazakhstan, for Kazakhstan. So it is kind of maybe time to think, what is your real purpose?
Okay. Could I...
Yes, I understand. The overall idea is to make life better, democracy, human rights, but what is your real purpose and instruments?
Okay. Well, I'll address your comment first and then return to your colleagues. We always seek to engage with the government in question, wherever we are working. That is our primary goal, is to bring recommendations about our findings, where there are human rights abuses, and engage with the government in with those recommendations on how to address the abuses. In our research recently, that is exactly what we did. When we resort to foreign policy pressure, as you put it, it's when we don't get the kind of engagement that we would like and see the changes that come about. It is another avenue for pressuring a government to change. But one cannot talk about our work without an acknowledgement of our willingness and indeed purpose in engaging with the government in question. In terms of recognizing positive developments of Kazakhstan, this is something that we do. We may differ on how we see those positive developments. We recognize that there has been great economic growth in Kazakhstan, for instance. It's true that the Congress of World Religions takes place, but that doesn't mitigate the very real problems and human rights abuses that are occurring every day in Kazakhstan. And so you can't talk about acceptance of all faiths in Kazakhstan without recognizing that you have a very repressive religion law and how that affects religious communities in Kazakhstan. You can't talk about economic growth without talking about labor rights violations in the sector that is primarily responsible for that economic growth and the broad prohibition, for instance, on the right to strike, which is not in line with ILO conventions to which Kazakhstan is party. So those questions are ones that we posed to the Kazakhstan government. We didn't get responses about about how Kazakhstan is going to bring its legislation in line or bring about more respect for those rights on the ground in Kazakhstan in a way that shows us that there is true political will behind some of these issues that you have mentioned as showing that Kazakhstan is keen to improve its rights record or that it has greater rights respect than our assessment would lend itself to.
Can I just add something to Jeff? Just a very quick point. Just two tiny things, just from a broader Human Rights Watch perspective.
I'm sure you can just identify yourself. Identify yourself.
Yeah, sorry. Hugh Williamson. I'm the Director for Europe and Central Asia of Human Rights Watch. Two quick things in response. Thanks for your comments. I remember very practical and interesting and useful meetings Mira and I had in Astana in September 2012, following work on the rights abuses around Janosen with senior government officials and prosecutors and so on. So we have regular dialogue with the Kazakhstan government. So you know, there's no suggestion we only engage with foreign actors to have influence on Kazakhstan. We engage regularly. We write letters regularly to the Kazakhstan government and prosecutors. So that's the first point. Second point, your suggestion that be better to be based in the country. In fact, as you may know, we've tried repeatedly to register an office in Almaty, and I think 5-6 attempts in the last 3 or 4 years, and every attempt has been refused, sadly. We now have an office in Bishkek.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on the issue of progress in Kazakhstan over the last 20 years, which is in some facets undeniable. My first visit to Kazakhstan was actually just a little bit more than 20 years ago. And when I arrived there, there was a vibrant media sector, including television, that provided views other than those of the government. There was a parliament that actually contributed to policy making and was not dominated by a single party. It was a poorer country. At the same time, it was a country that was noticeably better in terms of income equality. So even on the economic side, while Kazakhstan has a great deal to be proud of, I would think that for Kazakhstanis themselves, the issues of income distribution, bad governance, and corruption have to be causes of concern. So no one is trying to denigrate or say that good things haven't happened. The point is to focus on where progress still needs to be made. Sir?
Yeah. Ken Meyer, the young lady.
I'm sorry, can you, your affiliation, I didn't hear.
World Docs. It's a TV show. The young lady spoke about fundamental human rights. One of my complaints with organizations like Human Rights Watch is that you seem to be more concerned about some rich man having the right to print lies in a newspaper than you are with people getting enough to eat. I'm going to guess that you would recognize things like food, shelter, health care as fundamental human rights, but you attempt to rank them compared to things like freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. For instance, if a regime, as these gentlemen pointed out, is doing quite well in raising the living standards of their people, but it's a closed society, closed borders, censorship, whatever, one-party government. What sort of grade do they get? Cuba would be an example of that as well, I think. But conversely, if the country was an open society, a vibrant democracy, freedom of the press, open borders, but the living standards of its people were declining, what sort of grade does it get from Human Rights Watch? And we have examples, we have test cases from the 1990s, when open society was very successful in introducing democratic institutions to Eastern European countries, while those countries went through the greatest, the fastest rate of improvisation in the world.
I'll just say that, you know, I think if you visit our website, if you examine Human Rights Watch in depth, you'll see that not in the past 5 years, but more like the past, you know, 15 years. We have been writing reports on economic, social, and cultural rights just as much, if not more, than our work on civil and political rights. So by no means do we ignore or not, you know, and as you say, we don't give
can
grades.
Can you please let him answer?
We don't give grades to countries. We don't rank them. We don't actually compare them to one another either. What we try to do is assess the overall human rights situation in our world report. And I think what we've been doing is giving an interview, an overview of those concerns. But I should say on Central Asia, one of the reasons we have to focus on civil and political rights is because the region itself, with some exceptions, is really in a way innovating in the world today in its violation of civil and political rights. And it deserves attention mainly because authoritarianism seems to be actually retrenching, taking more root in this region than it is in a lot of other countries, and it's quite anomalous. So I think it deserves a lot of attention. But of course, we absolutely do look at the social rights, the economic rights. Those are absolutely important. So, and they often go hand in hand, and they can't be advanced effectively without transparency, without democracy, without freedom of expression, I think. You know, he's not a Central Asia expert, but I think Amartya Sen showed that pretty well, that you can't have economic development and advancement without democracy. So I'll just leave it there.
And just specifically on Kazakhstan, to say that while there has been great economic advancement over the last 20-plus years, there still remains quite a high poverty level in Mangistau Oblast, which is where the strikes took place in 2011, and that at the same time, even though there has been economic development, that shouldn't somehow result in less attention being paid to the curb, the restrictions on civil and political rights. It's not, one does not come at the expense of the other, or one is not mitigated by the other. There is a responsibility by signing up to these international human rights standards to move in a positive direction on all of them, economic and social rights, as well as civil and political rights. So while Kazakhstan has made great strides in terms of its economic standards and in living standards in the country, there are still very serious human rights problems as it concerns the political space for expression and criticism of government.
Well, I'll just point out that the fundamental rights related to living standards were not mentioned until these gentlemen brought it up.
Well, you know, if we go back to Uzbekistan, a third of the country is out of the country because they can't find jobs there. So, I mean, we're here to talk. We're here to talk about Central Asia and not about international standards. But I would say that my guess would be that if you ranked it, many of the countries that score well on political rights are also the ones that score well on economic rights. I mean, that's historically been the case. So, Central Asia focused questions.
Комментарий можно было, да? Я извиняюсь, я на русском скажу, потому что...
Okay, so we have one in Russian comment. Can you identify? Как вас зовут?
My name is Zilan Khan. I'm visiting professor at American University.
Mm-hmm. From where?
American University.
American University.
No, from... Откуда вы?
Казахстан.
From Kazakhstan.
Я исследователь.
I'm a researcher.
Вопросами безопасности, терроризма.
On questions of security and terrorism.
Вот как раз я недавно мы завершили анализ уголовных дел просто терроризм и провели встречи в колониях в том числе.
We've recently conducted research on extremism and terrorism, including interviews in prisons.
То есть это будет первый, наверное, опыт не то чтобы в Центральной Азии, а может быть даже в СНГ, когда мы проанализировали уголовные дела и еще плюс встречи с осужденными в колониях по такой чувствительной теме, как терроризм.
So this will be perhaps the first case in all the countries of the CIS in which we have analyzed criminal cases and met with people in prisons on such very sensitive cases as extremism and terrorism.
Касательно выступления по ситуации по правам человека, мне кажется, здесь нужно более такой сбалансированный, объективный подход.
I think when we come to such issues as human rights, we need an objective and balanced approach.
Потому что в Казахстане нет фундаментальных каких-либо проблем в области сферы прав человека.
Because in Kazakhstan there are no fundamental problems in the sphere of human rights.
Да, есть случаи, но мне кажется, вот те отмеченные случаи и так далее, которые они фиксируются, они, наверное, в результате определенной большей открытости в обществе, которая сейчас на данный момент существует.
There are individual cases, some of which you mentioned, but I think the fact of these cases being known is a symbol of the greater openness of society.
Люди иногда задаются вопросом, раньше катастроф или чрезвычайных происшествий при Советском Союзе не было, а сейчас как будто бы много. Нет, также просто сейчас об этом, наверное, много пишут, об этом много говорят. Точно так же и с этими событиями, случаями, точно такая же ситуация.
So it's somewhat like in the Soviet Union there were never any disasters and now there are, and it's not because there weren't before, but now because people are speaking more openly about them, and this is the same phenomenon.
Сейчас есть много каналов информации, благодаря которому любой случай получает определенное освещение.
So now there's the internet, various channels of information, because of which individual cases are become widely known.
Поэтому я бы не сказал бы, что в динамике есть тенденция ухудшения ситуации. Мне кажется, наоборот, нужно приглашать к определенному диалогу, сотрудничеству, правительству и другие структуры для того, чтобы обсуждать.
So I would say the dynamic is not towards a worsening of the situation, and I think what's necessary is a greater dialogue and consultations, including with government.
Когда мы говорим, что закрылись какие-то газеты, нужно тогда в то же время говорить, какие новые открылись.
So when you say that they closed down newspapers, I think you also need to ask which new ones have they opened.
Сейчас появились даже уже оппозиционные цветные журналы, которые продаются в 100 метрах от Акарты.
So now there have appeared opposition newspapers in color format that you can find 100 meters from the presidential palace.
Или когда мы говорим о жанновидении, да, это была трагедия, но в любом случае надо еще также отметить, что также уголовное наказание получили сотрудники, руководители правоохранительных структур. То есть было стремление государства к открытому, прозрачному оценке этих событий.
So when we look at Jan Ozan, yes, it was a tragedy, but I think we also need to look at the fact that members of law enforcement agencies were also punished for their actions and that the government tried to create an open, honest evaluation of what happened.
Поэтому я, мой комментарий, завершаю. К тому, чтобы, когда мы подходим к анализу ситуации в Казахстане, мне кажется, нужно, говоря о каких-либо проблемах, кейсах, случаях, и это обсуждать с целью дискуссии, с целью обсуждения более предметного для того, чтобы, наоборот, приглашать правительство дальше обсуждать и стимулировать, наоборот, приглашая государственные структуры.
So I think in conclusion that when we're discussing these issues we need to be as concrete and specific as possible with the goal of drawing the government into a dialogue on these issues.
Даже сейчас, последнее, даже сейчас мы здесь больше говорим о Казахстане, хотя, казалось бы, есть и поводы. Почему? Потому что открытости больше, и информации много, и, то есть есть поле для дискуссий, есть поле для сотрудничества.
И посольство более профессиональное, скажем. And so here, even just to conclude, say that, you know, we're talking about Kazakhstan more, not because the situation is worse there, but because Kazakhstan is more open.
I'd like to recognize that the Kazakhstan embassy is in our midst, and that's excellent for the purposes of dialogue. And we're keen on your responses to our recommendations. We are always open to engaging with you. There was a lot of emphasis put on the fact that the trials that took place after Jan Ozan were open. But an open trial is not a fair trial by definition. There were a lot of procedural violations over the course of the trial that undermined the defendant's rights to a fair trial. In the same regard, putting some police officers, holding some police officers accountable for their actions at Jan Ozan was not, did not fully acknowledge the scope of the loss of life, the killings that took place, the allegations of torture. And just as an example, Bazarbai Kenjabayev was a man who was detained in the aftermath of the violence. He was held in custody. He later succumbed to beatings that he alleged that he had sustained in custody, and the head of the detention center facility was imprisoned. However, no police officer was held accountable for the beatings that led to his death. So, yes, somebody was held accountable, but not the people that actually beat him and tortured him in custody. So there is a problem there with our understanding of what is the responsibility of the government in terms of respecting fundamental rights or rights in general. One other comment is when we're talking about a shrinking space for criticism, there is a dialogue, but then we can't ignore that it's not the closure of one newspaper or two newspapers or three newspapers. It's not a question of how many, but that it has continued to happen over the course of a very long period of time, that there's journalists are attacked and those attacks go on, that there are impunity for those kind of attacks, with rare exception, that persons who want to peacefully protest and make their grievances known to their government are detained and put into prison for 15 days. And it's not one case or two cases or three cases. It is any protest that has a message that is not in line with the government policies. And so we have to acknowledge that there is a very limited space for expression in Kazakhstan, even if other newspapers are opening. Because we're talking about the message of those newspapers and what they're willing to print and the grievances that people are willing to voice in a public space.
Would anyone like to open up the discussion beyond Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan? Please. Come to the table where there's a microphone.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Alisher Hamidov, and I'm an independent researcher who's now based in Osh and Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. I just want to brief you on recent developments in Kyrgyzstan, my native country. As you all know, Kyrgyzstan is still reeling after the 2010 violent regime change and ethnic conflict. In the wake of the so-called troubled 2010 events, the Kyrgyz government has made a number of crucial steps in beefing up state capacity, in responding to sources of stressors and conflict. So the Kyrgyz government is now fully in control of the country, at least that's what they say. So the Kyrgyz government is also trying to kind of reform crucial sectors, the judiciary, the law enforcement agencies. There's this campaign, anti-corruption campaign going on in Bishkek. So there have been some gains. But there are serious problems in Kyrgyzstan, human rights problems. I'll mention four areas. In terms of ethnic situation, Kyrgyzstan is a country of paradoxes. It is trying to democratize its institutions. It is claiming that it is a democracy, but some sizable segments of community, mainly ethnic minorities, women, some social groups, for example, Gypsies, they are feeling excluded from these democratic processes. Ethnic Uzbeks, they still complain of ill treatment. They still believe that many of the cases caused, kind of initiated after the 2010 events, are discriminating against them. They feel that the justice has not been done. It's not just the Uzbeks. Many Kyrgyz also feel that justice has not been served. In the area of media, Kyrgyzstan is enjoying this. Kyrgyzstan has one of the most vibrant media sectors. There have been serious gains in the past couple of years. Kyrgyzstan enjoys, many Kyrgyz citizens, they enjoy free media. But there's a negative side to it. There are a lot of chauvinistic mass media outlets that are challenging the situation. And in the area of religious freedoms, there's a disturbing trend that I want to turn everybody's attention to. On February the 3rd, President Atambayev has convened a gathering of the Kyrgyz Security Council. And at that council meeting, the government essentially announced that it will stiffen control over religious organizations. The Kyrgyz authorities said that the previous practice of letting religious groups to freely kind of enjoy all these freedoms was a wrong policy, and the government will stiffen regulation. So that's a cause of concern for many religious activists and ordinary believers. And in the area of gender, the Kyrgyz authorities, they claim that a lot of women are now becoming part of government and various processes. But a number of serious problems continue. Brides kidnapping is still an acute problem. Many ordinary women, they face obstacles in gaining access to decision-making process. Domestic abuse is still a flagrant violation. Thank you. So, in sum, there are positive and negative trends.
Okay, two more. Sebastian, did you want to say something?
Yeah, Sebastian Perouz, I'm working at the Central Asia Program at George Washington University. We know that the United States and the European Union have been putting pressure for years on Central Asia and Republic to try to improve the situation there in human rights. My concern, my growing concern, is that if we look at Central Asian Republic's foreign relations, I mean on the political and economic level, their main partners are Russia and China, which, to say the least, are not extremely concerned about human rights issues. And Russia, or I should say especially China, are really able to bring a lot of investments, a lot of loans to Central Asia, and China or Russia do not ask for any kind of political reforms. On the contrary, China and Russia really support the political regime of Central Asia. They support authoritarianism, whereas the United States and the European Union very rightly, with each loan, try to push for reforms, to at least to ask for an improvement in human rights. So there is such an imbalance between what China and Russia are able to do in Central Asia on the economic and political level with what the European Union or the United States are able to do. So my question is, how can the European Union and the United States compete with China and Russia influence? How can we put pressure on in an efficient way on these republics? How can we convince these countries to engage in more reforms, considering the way of China and Russia there?
In terms of I think that the point of departure would be to recognize that countries that have a foreign policy with a human rights mandate can remain principled. That it's really important to recognize that there is strength in that position. It is in the interest of Central Asian governments who are balancing a range of bilateral relationships with China, with Russia, along with the European Union, with the US, that it is important to maintain that balance to one degree or another, and that the strength then of the US or the EU approach, if you will, against the Chinese or Russian approach is that it is with the given that it, that that they're playing this balancing act, that that they do have a position of some, you know, not power, but a bargaining position, an important position to play in that balance. That it's not necessary to undermine that position in order to seek kind of geopolitical to pursue geopolitical interests or economic interests. I may stop there, but I that would be my approach: is that you have a principled position, and it's important to maintain that, recognizing that that one is not going to shun you just because of that position.
Right. I mean, I would completely agree with that. I'd say I think what Mira is describing is, and what we call for is principled engagement by the West with the Central Asian governments. And you know, I think, as many scholars have pointed out, the one thing that really sets Western actors apart in their engagement with this region is their stated objective to promote human rights and democracy. That's really, you know, that is their card that they can and should play that sets them apart from China and Russia. And, you know, what does that mean? I mean, I think that, you know, we often get accused in the human rights community of advocating isolationism, sanctions, when what we're calling for is principled engagement. And that means, as I said in my comments, being more public in your statements. When you go to Tashkent, for example, and you're with the State Department, or your, you know, Catherine Ashton, for example, you can meet with, you can go to the home of the family members of an imprisoned dissident and make a public statement, even though it's going to be, may cause some rifts, it may make it harder to visit the next time, but it's important. It's a message to the 30 million citizens of Uzbekistan on where you stand, that the EU and the US are on the right side of history. I think another, you know, maybe more concrete roadmap or guideline that the West can look to are their own laws. I mean, when you're talking about Washington and Uzbekistan, there are three laws here that have relevance to human rights, which are simply not being utilized in the way they could be. You have the International Religious Freedom Act, which, you know, if certain standards are not met on religious freedom, sanctions can be imposed or at least threatened. You have the Leahy Amendment, which restricts military assistance to countries that violate human rights. Uzbekistan was one that was subject to those restrictions for many years, and then now for the last two has been able to purchase and receive certain forms of non-lethal equipment from the United States, despite having such an atrocious human rights record. And then you also have the Trafficking Act, which is another lever, another very important, as I noted, it was a sign when that designation was made that Uzbekistan did respond in some way to that designation. And so the legal frameworks are important. When it comes to the EU, the Foreign Affairs Council of the EU outlined its own criteria upon which a meaningful bilateral relationship could be founded, and those criteria were five or six human rights demands that Tashkent still has not met. And so the EU, I think we encourage the EU and the US to go back to their legal and policy frameworks, their published statements, their documents, and see that those objectives are met, constantly refer to them in public, not only in private, and be prepared to impose consequences when they're not met. And that means having a discussion, a really frustrating and difficult discussion that may include the word sanctions, but may not lead to them being imposed, but just being willing to discuss the real panoply of options. And finally, the UN is another place that can be used. Both Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan are serial violators and very blatant in their non-cooperation with the UN Human Rights Council, and it's a test of the UN Human Rights Council, of its own vitality, its relevance, to issue statements about the situations in those countries. I mean, you have Iran, North Korea, other examples where the UN has really taken a strong stand, and in some respects, with respect to Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan's lack of cooperation, I think we would think that the Human Rights Council is a place where the U.S. and the EU can, in a multilateral framework, make strong statements and push for concrete concrete demands. So those are just a few.
Sebastian, I would say that distance is a factor, obviously. The U.S. and the EU are a lot farther away than Russia and China, and therefore their ability to have an impact is going to be less. At the same time, it also makes them less threatening, which is why I think the Central Asians are very desirous of maintaining these relationships. I think the real question right now, particularly in this town, is the U.S. going to care about the region enough after Afghanistan to be willing to engage in this kind of engagement, be it principled or not? And I think we all understand that's a question that hasn't been answered yet, but that the historical precedent is not very good, that U.S. interest, at least in Central Asia, has generally tended to be a factor of U.S. interest in things happening outside of Central Asia. Melbourne?
Melbourne Mamula from the Voice of America. You focus a lot on the cases of political prisoners in Uzbekistan. And the Uzbek government does not even recognize the fact that they have political prisoners. They have a problem with the definition itself. And, you call on the U.S. officials every time they visit Uzbekistan to raise the issue of political prisoners. I've covered a lot of cases of political prisoners and their releases and their arrests, releases and rearrests. So what if, let's say, the Uzbek government will miraculously release all of what we believe political prisoners, Would that be such an indication of progress for Uzbekistan? Because they are continuing to arrest more, to prosecute more. To me, it seems that, and based on my observation, is that focus is so narrow because, they have released political prisoners like Sanjar Umarov and Yusuf Juma, and they left prisons after several years. They're sick. They left the country immediately, and they don't really have a lot of impact now on within the country. So why is there such a strong focus on the fates of those 12, let's say 15 people? Second question very quickly. Do you believe that what's happening in Tashkent regarding President's daughter Gulnara Karimova arrests, some claims of torture, and the whole campaign is a human rights issue? I recently interviewed former U.S. Ambassador John Herbst, who spent 3 years in the early 2000s in Uzbekistan, and he dealt with a lot of human rights issues too. His own time, actually, it was during his time that the UN Rapporteur Against Torture was allowed into the country. He believes that there is nothing that has to do with anything when it comes to human rights with what's happening in Tashkent right now. So,
two very very key questions. I mean, there are a lot of sides to the there are a lot of lessons that can be drawn out of the political prisoner problem. First, just to say first, why is it important? It's obviously important for the immediate humanitarian, from a humanitarian standpoint, a health standpoint. It's important to get some of imprisoned human rights activists, journalists out of prison, simply to get them out of that absolutely abysmal and atrocious situation that they're in. We know that Uzbek prisons do not comply with many international standards, and we know that many of them are subject to ill treatment and torture while in prison. Many who don't, for example, agree to sign apology letters to President Karimov have been beaten, and also their sentences are routinely extended on bogus grounds. For example, not placing your prison slippers in the right corner, not sweeping up after yourself. That's been used, actually, on the eve of someone's release who's been in prison already for 6-7 years to then extend it by another 4 or 5. And so we've simply got an absolutely urgent need to get many of these people out of prison. That would be the first point I'd make. Is it significant if they were to, if tomorrow President Karimov was to release, let's say that the 30-odd secular prisoners that I mentioned? Absolutely. I think it would be a huge sign of serious interest in making concrete reforms. The last time you saw a large-scale group release of prisoners was, surprise, surprise, on the eve of the sanctions review that the EU was holding. They were going to have a discussion about whether or not sanctions should be extended in Tashkent. The EU, all member states, had sanctions on Uzbekistan between the end of 2005 and October 2009. And it was on the eve of one of those consultations that 8 people were released. One of them, I think, was Mutabar Tajibayeva, a well-known human rights activist. And that was the last time you had such a significant group release. In recent years, it's been more of a trickle. And I didn't mention this in my comments, but while you did have about 4 or 5 older prisoners amnestied this year, you also had, unfortunately, in 2013, new human rights activists actually imprisoned and sent to jail, whereas in 2011, 2012, some of them were simply fined and then amnestied in the courtroom and allowed to leave. So you actually had their liberty deprived. So you have bad trends, but I think it would be significant. You also mentioned, though, in your comment, rightly, that in the cases of the most notable releases that we know about, Sanjar Umarov, Yusuf Chuma, they immediately had to leave the country. They could not continue to do any of their important work. And I think one of the demands that the U.S. has to make and the EU has to make is that when you release these folks, you have to allow them to resume their work. And many of them are elderly and in poor health and unable to continue on for that reason, but many cannot work because they are in a situation of total isolation, censorship, sometimes quasi-house arrest. We saw the president's own nephew, Jamshid Karimov, a journalist, was released and then essentially confined to his house. Some people believe taken to a psychiatric facility after that. It also, though, it's, of course, these are the people that will be the future of a different Uzbekistan. They're also important because many of them are potential reformers. They have an interest in the future of politics in Uzbekistan. They have ideas. They have political platforms, some of them. Some of them are not human rights activists. Some of them are peaceful political oppositionists, like Mukhammad Bikjanov. So these people have to be taken seriously. They should be engaged with, and Washington and Brussels should not only approach them as humanitarian cases for release, but as the people that you will work with, hopefully, in a new Uzbekistan when change comes. On to the second question.
To be quick.
Well, is it a human rights issue? It's very complicated, and there's a lot we don't know. It's the first time we've seen politics as such happening in Tashkent in a way it hasn't happened in a long time. There was actually reported by Uznews yesterday that Gulnara was under house arrest, placed under house arrest on February 17th, essentially that her business and longtime romantic partner was detained along with 2 others. in connection with a criminal investigation, which was actually announced on the website of the Uzbek General Prosecutor site. It is confirmed there is a criminal investigation against her business associates and her partner. But if it is true that they were detained and are under house arrest, or that she is under house arrest, what does that mean? Is it a human rights issue in the classic sense? You know, we don't know how she would be treated in those circumstances. But if it is true that she's detained without charge, without access to a lawyer, it certainly drives home the point that nobody has rights in Uzbekistan, not even the daughter of the president, that due process, denial of access to counsel are things that all citizens in Uzbekistan face. And I think it drives home the sort of, you know, the perversity, the absurdity of the human rights situation in Uzbekistan. And that also should at least tip off, I think, policymakers to the idea that they need to start sending a message now to the future leaders of Uzbekistan that that they will build their relationship based on how human rights are protected, not on who is in power. It's not important who eventually takes the reins. It's important how they govern. So
our speakers have to leave in just a minute, so maybe one final intervention. Kathy, had you wanted to? You'll need to come to the table.
Soviet governments in particular, although governments in other parts of the world too, recognize that potentially religious groups and religious adherents could represent a very significant source of political and other opposition to tyrannic regimes. Uzbekistan's law, 1998 religion laws, unfortunately set the bar or the low standard for Central Asia. And all of the countries of Central Asia now have very similar religion laws. They're put into effect in different ways, but unfortunately they are on the books and can and often are acted on. I did want to say, in fairness to Kazakhstan, that their atheist blogger, Alexander Harlamov, whom you mentioned, did undergo psychiatric examination but was found sane. Mm-hmm. So he was not subjected to psychiatric abuse the way the pastor was. And in the case of the pastor, I find it particularly sad and ironic that he stands accused of harming the health of a parishioner at the same time that he underwent 1 month of psychotropic drug treatment with haloperidol, during which time he has testified in his trial that he felt like he was dying. And he's also gone deaf in 1 year. His heart condition has not been treated, etc. I could go on. As far as religious prisoners in Uzbekistan are concerned, they're probably the estimate keeps going up, and they're now, the best guess is they're probably as many as 12,000, which of course is more than political prisoners in any other post-Soviet country, as far as is known. And so thereby I end my comment. But thank you very much for this
speaker. Well, thank you all, and please join me in thanking our speakers. They have to take off for a meeting at the World Bank, but we appreciate their coming, and we appreciate your coming.
Thank you, Jeff, for hosting us.
Yes, thank you.